Local History, a talk. This is recorded in December 1992 by Angus MacLeod, Parco's Media Park. There are many sides to the local history of any district, and the history of the Park Peninsula is no exception. One could perhaps draw up a list of more than 20 headings that might be suitable subjects for an evening's discussion. Tonight, we propose to take as our subject an outline of the history of the Park Peninsula. Before we come to our subject for the evening, I would like to make three brief points in order to place our subject in the proper context. Firstly, local history is a very interesting and profitable subject. If we know our background and roots, we feel more secure and more sure of ourselves as we face the world. Our past educational system in this part of the world neglected to teach us anything about our own local history, language, and culture. And many of us feel that neglect was detrimental to our education and self-confidence and made us unsure of ourselves and apologetic and ashamed of our language, culture and history. That situation is changing now, fortunately, and it is very gratifying to know that our present educational regime is working hard to correct the errors of the past. And one of the ways in which they are doing that is to promote these talks. The second point I would raise is our local history is often shaped or influenced by national or even world events of history. It is useful to have a reasonable understanding of history in the wider context because that is sometimes necessary in order to understand local events. Certainly events at Scottish and British level affected us in Louis in the past. To give but one example, the rise of landlordism and commercial sheep farming, which had a profound effect on our lives in the island. The third point I wish to raise, the clearances from Southern Park. These clearances affected all the villages of Loughs because the fugitives scattered throughout Loughs and settled in most, if not all, the villages of Loughs. The effect was, 1, overcrowding in the villages, 2, it brought the people of Loughs closer together, 3, many of those evicted from Park and their immediate descendants wanted to return to Park if an opportunity arose. 4. That is why people from every village in Loughs, both north and south, took part in the famous Park Deer Raid in 1887. And again, many of them were involved in the land raiding in Park in 1891, as well as many other demonstrations culminating in the land raiding of the 1920s. The world is changing continually, including our local situation, and that is why we should endeavour to understand these changes and learn from our past history, particularly the mistakes of the past. We now come to the subject for this evening, which is an outline of the history of Park. We shall divide the subject under two headings. First one is the early history of Park, and the second one will be the more recent history of Park. Now, the early history of Park first. Very little is known about the early history of Park But there is evidence to show that there were people living in Bark a long, long time ago. And in fact, there seems to have been several waves of settlers in Bark in the past. That brings us to a statement made by William Mackay, one time factor of the Lewis estate, which seems to contradict the contention that there were inhabitants in Bark for thousands of years. Let us take the factor's statement first, and then glance at the early history of Bark. The following statement was made, was part of a written statement presented by William Mackay, the Lewis estate factor, to the McNeill government inquiry into crofting. And later on, the same statement was quoted by the chairman of the Grand Royal Commission, known as the Deer Forest Commission, in 1892. The factor statements were as follows. The parish of Lochs appears to be the most recently inhabited parish, and I quote, recently inhabited parish in the island of Lewis. At the time of the Earl of Seaforth, the whole of what is now known as Bark was a deer forest, and the crofters of Oog used to graze their sheep there in the summer, or had shearings there. End of quotation. Factorial statements may not always be very reliable. Estate officials are known to be somewhat prejudiced in their judgment of matters relating to crofting. At the time of the factor's statement, the Lewis estate had just converted the whole of the 42,000-acre Bark sheep farm in Southern Bark into a sporting deer park. That was in 1886 for the entertainment of the affluent rich from the Industrial Society of the Sun. Naturally, Lewis estate wanted to divert the attention of the McNeill inquiry into crofting and the Brand inquiry into deer forests away from the deprived landless families that were refused permission to occupy even an inch of that land, preferring to create a sporting deer forest. Strictly speaking, the factor was quite wrong to say that Bark was a deer forest when Seaforth Mackenzie came to Lewis. Certainly there were deer roaming in Bark as there were in other parts of the island. There were, for instance, deer roaming in Arnish near Stornoway, etc. The point is that there were no sporting deer forests in Bark, similar to the Bark deer forest, until 1886. In earlier times, the deer and the people lived happily side by side in many parts of the highlands and islands because there were no restrictive game laws preventing local people from taking either deer or salmon for their own use until the Day Trespass Act of 1832. The other factor to remember is that Lewis was sparsely populated in earlier centuries. For instance, in 1755 there were only 6,386 people in the whole of Lewis. It was in the 19th century that the population increased rapidly. Between 1775 and 1900, that's about 150 years, the population increased nearly five times over. I maintain, therefore, that the factor statement was misleading, and that it was not a true picture of the facts of history. Let us look briefly at what is known about the early history of Bark, beginning with the Picts, which were in Old Testament times, we are told. It is said that they built the brochs or duns scattered throughout the highlands and islands in Old Testament times. There is the ruins of a broch on an island in Loch Cramore, and that dates the occupation of Park, or at least parts of the Park Peninsula, back possibly to Old Testament times. Of course the Picts were in Scotland in New Testament times as well, before they left, of course, because King Kenneth MacAlpin of the Gaels also became king of the Picts in 843 AD. That indicates that the Picts were well on the way out by then. We will not prolong our discussion of the Picts. Suffice it to say that it is indeed a solemn thought to think that there were people here in these parts thousands of years ago. Then we come to St. Columba's followers. Probably they were the next wave of settlers in the Park Peninsula. The evidence of their presence in Park is to be found in St. Columba's Church in the island of that name in Lough Erthod. It is said that the followers of St. Columba's came to Lewis before 800 AD. We will leave the followers of St. Columba's at that and move on to the third wave of settlers known to have been in Park, the Scandinavians. The Scandinavians were said to have overrun Lewis about 800 AD, and their rule in Scotland ended in 1263 AD at the Battle of Largs and the Treaty of Perth. The Scandinavians were in Scotland, therefore, for about 450 years, and they left about 700 years ago. Let us look briefly at the Clan MacLeod now. The Clan MacLeod held sway in Lewis for three or four centuries prior to Seaforth coming in 1610, and that would bring them up to about the time the Scandinavians left. Where did the MacLeods of Lewis come from? Were they a mixture of Norse and Gaels? Did some of them live in Park? Or did any of them live in Park? Well, there is very little evidence of the MacLeods being there, but I maintain there was somebody there. We now come down to the Seaforths. The followers of Seaforth were the fourth, if not the fifth, wave of settler in Park. They came in 1610, and that was nearly 350 years after the Scandinavians were said to have left Scotland. We know that Park was occupied continuously since Seaforth came nearly 400 years ago. But the interesting question is, was Park inhabited before Seaforth came? And during the long period of 350 years since the Scandinavians left until the Seaforths came? That question leads us directly to the prevalence of Scandinavian place names all over the Park Peninsula. How did these Scandinavian place names of almost every feature of the topography of Park survive for 350 years if Park was not continuously inhabited from Scandinavian days down to the present day? I maintain that the peninsula of Park was continuously inhabited from ancient times down to this day, and therefore William Mackay, the Lewis estate factor, is quite wrong to say that the parish of Lochs, and by that I'm sure he meant Park, was the most recent parish in the island of Lewis to be inhabited. It is not likely that the Scandinavians pulled out in one day. It is more likely that some of them lingered on and were absorbed by the Gaels and what was left of the Picts, and therefore these people lived in Park. Now we will turn to our second heading, an outline of the recent history of Park. As already stated, we believe that there is ample evidence to show that the Black Park Peninsula was inhabited continuously since Seaforth Mackenzie came in 1610. But additional settlers came to Park in the 18th century, and many of his can trace their ancestors to the West Coast or Louise, or Hugh Louise, or Harris. In my own case, our MacLeods came from Garraman in Conway, and my mother's people, the Nicholsons, came from Hugh. We might mention that Seaforth built a stronghold for himself in Park at Seaforth Head, and surrounded himself with his own clansmen from the mainland and their associated clans in order to take care of his security and protect himself from the numerous clan MacLeod. Seaforth planted taxmen all over Loss, and even 100 years later, in 1718, many of the Loss taxmen were Mackenzies. Maniuma, gentitagunya hena, to do good to your own people. Perhaps I should define a taxman briefly at this stage. Taxman, natuinuisel, were middlemen. Middlemen that actually belonged to the clan system. The clan chief was the head of the clan. The chief leased large areas of land to the taxman on a long-term basis. The taxman in turn sublet the land to smallholders, or the equivalent to crofters, on an annual basis, without any security of tenure. In the clan system, the taxmen were the officer class, as if it were. Only the name of the taxman may be found in the estate rent roll. The smallholders, which the taxmen attracted to settle round him, paid their rent to the taxman, very often in kind or labour, and their name was never entered or recorded in a book. And that is why it is so very difficult to trace the names of the early Crofter settlers. The early tax with the smallholders that lived on the tack formed the basis of our present villages. If there were taxmen or smallholders in Park when Seaforth Mackenzie came in 1610, he would have absorbed them into his own system, or alternatively got rid of them because they might be a potential security risk to his regime if they were too friendly or sympathetic to the Clan MacLeod. Sometimes the whole of the Park Peninsula might have been leased as one big tack, with probably sub-tacksmen. We know of one occasion in 1739, when Colin Mackenzie, Callan Jarrach, became Chamberlain of Louise, he used his influence to get a lease of the whole of the Park Peninsula on favourable terms for his son-in-law, Donald MacNeill, known locally as MacNeill in Ilan, because he lived in Ilan Chalamgilia in Loch Hiddesford. That is why it is very difficult to trace all the taxmen of Park, far less the smallholders. We don't know, you see, there was always taxmen and subtaxmen. When Mr. MacNeill's lease of the whole Park expired in 1776, after 37 years, the area was leased to various individuals once again. The 18th century was a time when there was a lot of influences at work that affected the people of the Highlands and Islands, such as, Culloden was one of them, then the rise of landlordism, the Industrial Revolution in the South, the rise of commercial sheep farming in the Highlands and Islands, the rise of the kelp industry, the fishing, a rapid increase of the population. Some of these events resulted in a redistribution of the population. For instance, kelping brought a lot of new settlers to Park in the 18th century, and so did the fishing. We know that the whole of the Park Peninsula was inhabited. In fact, it was said that there were more people in the southern half of the peninsula than there were in the northern half, now under Crofton. And that was in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. That leads us to ask several interesting questions, such as, why did our ancestors come to Par? Where did they come from? What were they doing in Par? Why did Park decline and depopulate? These four questions are very comprehensive, and it would take too long to cover them in detail. We will attempt to give an outline answer. It might sound strange if I was to say that the Park Peninsula was a very good place to live in the 18th century. In fact, one of the best, if not the best, part of the island at that time. That, in short, is why the people came there. Kelping, for instance, was very prosperous towards the end of the 18th century, and the Park Peninsula, with its numerous sheltered bays and sea lofts, was eminently suitable for kelping. Hence, the people were attracted to Park for an opportunity of earning money in kelping, very much the same as people do now with the oil. Fishing. In the 18th century, the sheltered bays and offshore banks of Park were teeming with fish of all kinds. Salting houses were established on the foreshore in many of the bays and anchorages in Park at that time. Robert Weir, the Culver's taxman, was said to be one of the leading fish curers in the island. The emphasis at that time was on whitefish, which they salted and dried on the beaches and shipped out. Then there was agriculture. As already noted, the whole island was sparsely populated in the early 18th century, and there would therefore be plenty of land available in Park for new crops and perhaps new settlements. The population was increasing, however, and perhaps pressures were building up on the west coast of the island, and what would be more natural than to make a new start in Park with the prospect of kelping, fishing, and land of your own? Communications. There were no roads anywhere in the island at that time, and people relied on boats a lot. The numerous anchorages and sheltered bays in the lochs was eminently suitable for boat people. In fact, a boat was an essential item for kelping, fishing, and travelling. The market town of Stornoway was only 1 hour away with a boat in a stiff breeze. Boats in Park in the 18th century was to these people the same as cars are nowadays to people everywhere. The standard of living in Park. The standard of life in Park in the 18th century was very high, if compared to the rest of the country at that time. The people had landholdings and homes and plenty of food, and were free to live a healthy outdoor life. They had plenty of fresh fish and fish products. He earned money on kelping and fishing to pay the rent, etc. Land was available for agriculture. The numerous water mills on the streams testify to the conversion of grain into meal. There was plenty of milk and milk products. plenty of potatoes to go with the fish, etc. Meat for the table from their own stock in a sheltered glens or park. Wool for carding, spinning, blanketing and cloth making. It was a self-sufficient economy. A happy and contented people. They asked for nothing. But they asked for nothing but to be left alone to build their own homes and earn their own living and raise their own children and live happily. That desirable state of affairs did not last long. Suddenly, their utopia was sheltered, shattered by what they regarded as commercial greed. Imposed on the indigenous people by the local administration in the name of improvements, as the landlords like to call these developments. The Lewis estate of Seaford Mackenzie decided that a commercial sheep farm be established in Park. And that, of course, would command a higher rent than the smallholders could pay, and they decided to launch that improvement scheme. The first commercial sheep farm in Lewis was established about 1802, first of all in a modest way in the small peninsula between Loch Brolum and Loch Cloyne in Southern Park. It was necessary to evict a few crofting communities such as Valamas, where the farmhouse was built, Valamas Vic, Cools and Yellow, Smoshevig, etc. By establishing a commercial sheep farming in Lewis, the estate was following the practice that was going on in the Highlands since about 1870, when the Cheviot chief, Nacoothie Fora, first came to the Highlands in order to meet the demand for wool and mutton coming from the prosperous towns and cities created in the Industrial Revolution in the South. For the first 40-odd years of the 19th century, the indigenous people of Park were harassed and continuously evicted as the Park sheep farm expanded northwards onto the land occupied by a crofting population, the population being pushed out of the way of the sheep, pushed northwards. The crofters had no security of tenure, and they had no vote, and they were not organized. They were therefore helpless and at the mercy of ruthless exploiters, both in the shape of the Lewis estate and the tenants of the sheep farm. They weren't much better than the estate people themselves. Listen to George Mackenzie Laxey Lochs giving evidence to the Napier Commission at their meeting in Cowes on 12th June 1883. His family was evicted in 1828, and I quote, says George, "I came to Laxey at the age of 8 years, along with my father and 10 other crofters, who were driven away with all their belongings from their thriving and agreeable holdings at Arlinan Park, in which they knew nothing beyond prosperity and happiness. Park, which nature seemed to mean for man, with all its arable lands, hill pastures and bays of the sea, offering grand opportunities of comfort as a reward to human industry, was quite unprecedentedly relieved of the inhabitants of 28 townships. To the perpetrators of such deeds, the discontentment and bitter feelings of the fugitive inhabitants appeared as nothing at all, compared to the peculiar pleasure they enjoyed from the fact that now the sheep and fleet-footed deer could graze on the meadows and on the heaths impiously depopulated. Some of these people were evicted to America, and others were scattered here and there on small patches of land." unquote. George Mackenzie and his friends were in no doubt that Park was a good place to live in the early part of the 19th century. The Park Sheep Farm had a profound influence on the local history and the life of the people of Loss, as may be seen from the evidence led by Crofters at the Napier and Brand Commission. George Mackenzie Laxey went on to state to the Napier Commission, and I quote, "I knew of a crofter in this village who was compelled to abandon 3 different holdings and 3 different new homes, which he built by the sweat of his brow on three consecutive years, without even a kind word in the way of aid or compensation for his labour, time and expenses." Unquote. Then was Sir John Smith Crofter, then at Balala. He testified to the Napier Commission that he was born in Eishkin about 1808, and that, and I quote, "his father's family were removed from Park because of the oppression of the people, dealt with as a flock of sheep driven by dogs into a funk." Unquote. The trauma and suffering of the people of Park came upon them as a result of the planting of the Park Sheep Farm on top of them. By 1833, the flood-tide Ocheviot sheep had pushed the crofters back past Eishkin to the boundary of Steamrowy's common grazing, and along the Harpost Common to the shores of Loch Erisod, effectively cutting off the present crofting villages of Park, because Cleichir, Shilginish and Seaforth were then within the Park Sheep Farm. Steamrowy. The only reason that the march of the Cheviot sheep stopped temporarily on the borders of Steamrowy was the fact that the crofters of Steamrowy held a long-term lease of the lands of Steamrowy, and they could not therefore be evicted. The lease was held by 2 of their number on behalf of all the crofters in the village. That sort of thing was done now and again. 9 years later, in 1842, the lease of the Park Sheep Farm, which was held by the Stuart brothers, Alexander and Archibald Stuart, was due to expire. They were known locally as Skillion Rognapadig, and no one was sorry when they announced they were leaving the island in 1842. In their place came Walter Scott of Hoyt, and the Lewis estate decided to take advantage of the change in the tenancy of the farm by promoting another improvement scheme. The improvement scheme at this time involved bypassing or hopping over Steamrowy, which was still held on a long-term lease by the crofters, and removing the crofters from the next 2 villages, Oranzy and Limerway. And that would bring the Park Sheep Farm to the borders of Gravert Common. There is little doubt that if the market for wool and mutton had held, all the people would be cleared from the whole of the Park Peninsula in due course. There was a hitch in the clearance of Limerway and Oranzy. Now, of course, that's a long story. The first attempt to clear them was in 1842, and the reason given by the estate for the clearance was the false charge of sheep stealing, which the people of Lochshell, as they were called, denied furiously and refused to move until these false charges were withdrawn, because they were concerned about their good name and reputation, they said. A strong posse of ejectors were dispatched from Stornoway, headed by the sheriff, if you don't mind, the procurator fiscal, constable, the state officials, etc., etc. But the women of Loch Shells turned on them, and they had to flee from the field as a dispute. That is how the clash is described, and we shall not stop at that interesting story just now. But in the passing, we may note that the first census figures in Lewes were taken in 1841, and we know from the census figures the names of all those who were in Limerick and Nornsey at the time of the attempted clearance in 1842, and again when they were successfully cleared in 1843. There were 36 families in Limerick, comprising of 180 souls, and there were 32 families in Nornsey, comprising of 145 souls, a total of 325 persons in the two villages. They were given a very short notice to quit. No alternative provision for rehousing or new landholdings were made for these hundreds of people. Just go. When they refused to leave in 1842, there followed a long wrangle until they were forced to leave in 1843. Now let me turn to the Lewes proprietor. The Lewes proprietor at that time was James Stuart Mackenzie of Seaforth. He was a member of Parliament for Ross and Cromarty, including Lewes, from 1830 to 1837. Then he became governor of Ceylon, where he was until his health broke down in 1841. While he was away, his estate was being administered by trustees. But doubtless he was responsible for the formulation of the broad lines of his state policy. He could, of course, safely leave the sordid details of such things as evictions, etc., to his trusted lieutenants. And one of these was the tyrant, the well-known tyrant, Donald Munro, who had just arrived in Lewes for the first time. So this was his first eviction in Park. The Lewes proprietor was therefore preparing to come home after his health broke down, when the tenancy of the Park Sheep Farm was changing hands from the Sheward brothers to Walter Scott of Hawick, and the crofters of Limerick and Nornsey were being evicted. In October 1843, the proprietor, James Stuart Mackenzie of Seaforth, died in Southampton on his way home from Ceylon, in his 59th year. By that time, the crofters of Limerick and Nornsey had been forcibly cleared. About half of them were resettled on new crofts in the new village of Crosby, and a few families were resettled in a small village, Glen Tolstein. The rest were scattered throughout the villages of Loch and Lewes. Mercifully, the clearance of Limerick and Nornsey was the last clearance from the Park Peninsula except that of Steamroway. Steamroway, which was left isolated in the middle of the sheep farm when Limerick and Nornsey was cleared in 1843, remained like that for the next 16 years until the next change in the tenancy of the sheep farm in 1857-58, when Mitchell Scobie took over from Walter Scott. The marooned crofters of Steamroway were moved then to Limerick on the edge of the sheep farm. And it is the descendants of these crofters that are still in Limerick. Now turn to Sir James Maston. Following the death of James Stuart Mackenzie of Seaforth in 1843, the island of Lewes was sold to James Matheson in 1844. James Matheson was a Highlander who made a fortune smuggling opium into China. Not long after Sir James Matheson bought the island, he relocked it, the whole island, that was about 1850. That was the second law thing. And these are the crafts that are still in existence to this day. The first plotting was carried out by Seaford, the previous provider, between 1814 and 1818. Now, a word on education. Education is a vital part of our local as well as our national history, but we will only touch on it here in the passing, as that is a subject on its own for an evening's discussion. Parish schools. The first parish school in Lochs was established at Cork in 1796 in a small thatched building. It was an English school. Next thing that happened was the Edinburgh Society for Gaelic Schools, a voluntary organisation. It was formed in 1811. They established Gaelic schools in the Highlands and Islands called Scolan Chliers, the Schools of Christ. They were the organisation that brought education to Patrick first. They opened a Gaelic school at Gravery in 1822, at Marwick in 1828 and at Cremore in 1829. It was these Gaelic school teachers that evangelized the island. Then the next society was Society in Scotland for Propagating Christian Knowledge, SSPCK. They opened a school at Lochshell in 1828. And the next lot was the Edinburgh Free Church Ladies Association, established in 1850. Their schools were called Scolan Ladies, the ladies' school, because it was run by ladies. They had a school in Cremore. Their school superintendent, in his report for 1858, said, quote, "There are four people in the Latin class in Cremore, one of them a girl, the first female classical scholar I encountered in the Hebrides." The Church of Scotland had a school. Then the Education Act of 1872 brought in compulsory education. The second statistical report written for Lochs by Reverend Robert Finlayson of the parish church at Cowes, which he wrote about 1832, and I quote, "There are only 12 people in Lochs that can write." It did not say whether that was in English or in Gaelic, but probably he was referring to English and referring to the taxman class. But many could read in Gaelic, he said. Half the people between 12 and 24 could read in Gaelic. That's distinct from writing. We shall leave education at that and come nearer to our own time. 1886 is a very important date in the history of the whole Highlands because of the first Crofters Act that was passed in 1886. And that ensured the continuity of crofting. Because crofters got, for the first time ever, security of tenure. Security of tenure. Without security of tenure and the other safeguards of the 1886 Crofters Act, it is very doubtful if there would be anyone living in Ruler Lewis today. We shall leave the 1886 Act with one other important observation. The landless families. Now, the landless families were totally disregarded by the 1886 Act because that Act gave them nothing. The Act left them where they got them. They did not have any land before the Act and they did not have any land after the Act. despite the fact that they campaigned and agitated hard for the 1886 Act, along with the Crofter who had land. Now that failure affected the history of Lewis in a profound way in the subsequent 40 years, and to some extent it is still affecting us. It was the failure of the 1886 Crofter Act that led to a continuation of the campaigning for land law reform and land raiding, particularly in the Hebrides. The second and last lotting, as we have seen, took place about 1850, and there were a rapid acceleration in the growth of the population of Lewis during the rest of the 19th century. That fact, together with the clearances, ensured that there were serious overcrowding in all the villages of Lochs, and indeed all the villages of Lewis. And the landless families had to live in barns, on their parents' and in-laws' crofts, because the landlord refused to make any land available for new crofts. It is estimated that there were nearly as many landless families in Lewis towards the end of the 19th century as there were families with crofts of their own, and the situation was getting worse and worse. Meantime, commercial sheep farming in the Highlands and Islands was feeling the cold air of competition from frozen meat from Australia and New Zealand. And by the 1870s, commercial sheep farming in the Highlands was no longer viable, and the southern sheep farmers were leaving the Highlands like rats leaving a sinking ship. Coincidental with the decline of the commercial sheep farming in the Highlands was the rise of sporting deer forests. And Highland landlords were even offered a higher land rent, for deer forests than they were fetching for land for the sheep farms. The result of this was the conversion of sheep farms into sporting deer forests all over the Highlands. Meantime, Mitchell Scobie had passed his lease of the Bark sheep farm to P.P. Sellar, the son of the infamous Patrick Sellar of Sutherland Clearance fame. The deprived landless families of Lochs were well aware that commercial sheep farming was in decline, and they were also aware that the lease. The lease of the Park sheep farm was due to expire in 1883. They therefore anticipated the expiry of the lease of the Park sheep farm by several years by applying early for permission to reoccupy some of the former Crofter villages in Southern Park from which their forefathers were evicted. Sir James Matheson died in 1878, and therefore the applications and petitions for land for resettlement schemes was addressed to Lady Jane Matheson. In order to illustrate the situation, I will give details of one such petition as follows. It came from 32 landless families from Graver, Calvus, Marivic, and it is dated 22/11/1881. And I quote, "We, the undersigned fishermen, labourers, and Royal Naval Reservists, men, residing in the parish of Lochs, Lewis, understanding that the present lease of the Park sheep farm expires at Whitsun 1883, would take the liberty of approaching your ladyship on the subject. At present we are either squatters or hold small patches of land from other crofters in these townships, all of which are quite inadequate for the support of ourselves and our families." Unquote. Then they went on to bind themselves to conform to and obey all the rules and regulations of the estate and submit to any new rules that may be considered necessary. They also undertook to protect the interests of the proprietor and his sporting tenants. Then they identified the area they wanted in the following terms, and I quote, "We must respectfully solicit the portion of land known as Steamroy and Oranse." Now, as everybody knows, Steamroy and Oranse were two former crofting townships, cleared. Steamroy and Oranse, which were at one time let to tenants, be set aside in order to be let to the undersigned in such lots or parts and at such reasonable rents as may be arranged." Unquote. After waiting some time for a reply, they called on the chamberlain several times to remind him that they were waiting for a reply. Nearly a year passed without any response from the estate, so they wrote again on 5th October 1882 in the following terms. Calvus Loss, 5th October 1882. I quote, "We have patiently waited for the last 12 months for your reply, having called for the same at your offices repeatedly to no purpose. We must respectfully request a reply in writing so that we may consider what steps should be taken so as to secure our object. We expect that the prayer of such petitions has been favourably received by Lady Matheson and all concerned, and that our very distressing conditions, which is becoming more and more serious, may induce you to give us an opportunity of earning an honest livelihood in our native island, especially when such a suitable opening occurs. Waiting your reply, in name and on behalf of said petitioners, we respectfully remain your obedient servants, Kenneth Nicholson, Kenneth MacLeod, and many others." Unquote. 2.5 months later, the petitioners were still waiting for a reply from the estate, and on 23rd December 1882, they wrote again as follows. Calvus Loch, Stornoway, 23rd December 1882. Lady Matheson of the Lewes. "Honoured Lady, on behalf of a number of fishermen residing at Calvus, Marwick and Graven, in the parish of Loch, I beg leave most respectfully to send you herewith a copy of a petition addressed by us to your ladyship through Mr. Mackay, Chamberlain of Lewes, last January, and to which we had no reply, trusting we that we may not be led reluctantly to such steps as many of our unfortunate countrymen are forced to adopt. May we take the liberty of asking that you be so good as to let the petitioners know your own views regarding the matters contained in the petition. I have the honour to be your ladyship's obedient servant, Kenneth Nicholson." About that time, as a resolution was passed at a public meeting in Park, and a deputation delivered the resolution from the meeting to the castle at Stornoway, and the resolution read as follows, and I quote, "This meeting deeply regret that Lady Matheson did not deem it her duty to answer the petitioners and the petitions and statements sent to her from this township, from the township south of La Fuerza, or show any desire to remove the grievance under which these crofters labour. And quote, on the same evening, in the same meeting, another resolution was passed as follows. The meeting is of the opinion that no rent should be paid by the crofters until a satisfactory reply has been received from the landlord. No reply was received from the landlord. Lady Matheson, from the landlord, Lady Matheson, and no croft rents were forthcoming from the crofters of Park. Such was the solidarity at Park that a free church elder from Gravel was declared boycotted and outcast for having broken the rent strike by paying his rent. In fact, the whole island population was in a state of protest against the landlord because of the denial of land to the indigenous population. In 1882, some 9,000 people marched in Stornoway as a demonstration with 16 pipers at their head. That would be about one-third of the whole population of the island, or you may say, about all the able-bodied people in the island. At that demonstration, resolutions were passed demanding the restoration of the land to the people, as well as fair rents and security of tenure. At last, on the 3rd of January 1883 came Lady Matheson's reply to the petitioners of Calvus, Marwick and Graver. It came from Cleveland Row, London, her London residence, and reads as follows, and I quote, Lady Matheson regrets that the above-named respectable class of fishermen should have been led to address her on the subject of such importance as that contained in her petition, by adding to it a letter which causes her to set aside their petition, as Lady Matheson is too devoted to her queen and the laws of which her gracious majesty is the representative, to listen for one moment to a petition accompanied by a threat from them to infringe the laws by which all are governed, and by the support of which, as individuals, the well-being of the land and its communities at large can alone be protected. It is interesting that Lady Matheson, in her letter, refers the crofters of Park to the laws of which Her Gracious Majesty is a representative. These laws were, of course, formulated and passed by the landed gentry and their friends. The crofter did not have a vote then. It was in 1884 that an act was passed giving male householders the vote. Even the sons, crofter's sons, living with their parents, did not get the vote until 1918. It was at the general election of 1885 that the crofters had the vote for the first time, and the landlord class in the Highland, class of MPs in the Highlands, were swept aside and crofter candidates elected to represent the Highlands. So that was a step forward. Now return to the vacant Park sheep farm. The lease of the sheep farm expired in 1883, and although the Lewis estate advertised the vacant farm as a sheep farm repeatedly in the following few years, there were no tenants to be found. Nevertheless, the Lewis estate was not prepared to make any land available for new crops, so the scores are to private deprived landless squatters living in squalor in barns and temporary homes over a long, long period of time. Instead, the Lewis estate converted the Park sheep farm, extended to 42,000 acres, into a sporting deer forest for a playground for the affluent rich from the industrial society in the south. The landless families were shattered and extremely angry. No new crofts were created except 6 crofts in the area of Sheldonish and Seaforth Head, about 5,000 acres, at a rent of £51 per croft. A glance at the map will show that the creation of these 5 crofts was a buffer zone created in order to withdraw to an effective sea boundary along Loch Seaforth for the newly created deer park. The boundary of the deer park then ran along Loch Seaforth and Loch Skippickley and the common grazing boundary of Steamrow to Loch Shell. So Steamrow and Oranse and the Shandiles were also denied to the crofters, and the next move was to create another buffer zone between the crofters in the northern part of the peninsula and the deer forest in the south by denying the landless families the use of Steamrow and Oranse. And it was these two former villages that was in greater demand than any other part. And adding insult to injury, by adding these two villages, extending to about 3,000 acres, to the viable farm of Crabbeck, some 8 miles away, which was tenanted at that time by Roderick Martin, a man from Ballala. The hundreds of landless quarters in Loch were left in their deprived condition, without land and without a home that they could call their own. To illustrate the scales of values of the management of the Lewis estate, let me say that the 68,000 acre Park Peninsula was divided into two areas. 42,000, or about 2/3 of the land surface of the peninsula, was allocated to a sporting deer park, and the remainder, 26,000, to the 1,700 people that was there at the time. That makes 15 acres per person, inclusive of common grazing, whereas the 600 to 700 deer that was then in the park deer forest works out at 60 acres each for the monarch of the glen. So there you are, 60 acres for the deer and 15 to the people. Another illustration of the conditions of living in of the condition of living in park at that time is that there were a total of about 180 crofts in the 9 villages. If the crofts are taken as usual at 5 acres each, it comes to 900 acres of in-by croft land, divided equally among the 1,700 people, and that gives each person well under half an acre per person of croft in-by land. Well now, how would you like to live on half an acre of land? That's not a very big farm. Now that explains the anger of the people of Loch in 1886 when the Park Deer Forest was created, and that is why they continued to agitate for an alleviation of their living condition. 5 years later, in 1891, there was a massive uprising in Loch. 18 men from Crossford, 10 men from Grammer, 10 men from Carlos, 11 men from Cromore, about 50 heads of families, land raided Steamrow and Oranse and Stromath. Court cases followed, some of the men were cast in prison in Inverness for the Maximum Term. The whole of Louis were in an uproar, and the government showed signs of worry that, and they indulged in the usual delaying tactics of setting up a royal commission, known as the Deer Forest Commission or the Brand Commission in 1892. That commission reported in due course, but it did not give the people of Park anything. As everyone knows, the Parc Deer Forest is still there, intact. In 1897, the government set up the Contested District Board. That board was seriously underfunded, and it did not, therefore, have much impact on the situation. In 1806, the Smallholder Scotland Bill was introduced into the House of Commons. It was designed to give the Scottish Secretary compulsory power to take all farmland from the landlords in order to promote resettlement schemes. Because of the resistance that bill encountered, it was 5 years before the House, before it was passed in 1911 as an Act of Parliament. Stymru and Arnsey were among the first few resettlement schemes under the 1911 Act, and that was in 1912. So they prepared for a resettlement scheme in 1912. But before the preliminary arrangements to resettle Stymru and Arnsey was complete, the 1914-18 war broke out, and all the resettlement schemes were shelled for the duration, and the Crofters and their families went off to the war. The war brought a change of attitude on the part of the establishment towards Crofters. It was a war to end all wars and create a land fit for heroes. Politicians went around making fine speeches. Mr. Robert Munro, the Scottish Secretary, let it be known that he was considering a suggestion put to him by the Louis Crofters and Cotters Association. The suggestion was, and I quote, that the government should purchase the island of Louis and make the best use of it as cultivation for crofters, fishermen and cotters to settle them after the war. Then the Lord Advocate, T.B. Morrison, in a speech in Inverness on 11th October 1917, said, and I quote, "We are entitled to expect that the land question in the Highlands should be settled once and for all. The evils of the old system are admitted practically on every hand, and everybody is agreed that the people of the Highlands must be placed in possession of the soil," etc., etc. "It has been demonstrated that farms, when broken up, carry a larger stock and support a larger population, while the unchecked expansion of deer forests has been nothing short of a national scandal." Unquote. How's that for T.B. Morrison? Expressions like these from people in high government positions encouraged the deprived landless Cotter people in the Highlands and Islands to think that the long weary battle for the land was won at last, or nearly won. Soldiers and sailors at the front were encouraged. They felt that if they did survive these years of terrible slaughter, suffering and sacrifice, they would at long last achieve their cherished dream of a small holding of their own on which to build a home for their families, and enjoy for the first time in their family lives the basic security that comes from the knowledge that they had a home that they could call their own. It was in that frame of mind that many of the war-weary ex-servicemen trickled back home in 1919 to be reunited to their wives and families in their temporary homes, only to discover that their dreams of a landholding of their own was but a cruel illusion. The landless families were expected to continue living in temporary accommodation, as was the case in the previous 50 years. The island of Louise was by now bought by a new landlord, Lord Lever. Unlike the previous landlord, Major Matheson, he resisted the government plans to resettle for resettlement schemes under the 1911 Smallholders Act. That was a bitter disappointment for the homeless, and particularly those like the Cotter of Limerway, etc., who had put their names forward for the proposed resettlement schemes in Stranraer and Onslow before the war. As a developer, Leverham was quick to notice that the two exploitable resources in his island of Louise was the fishing, or the fish and the people. Perhaps a good enough clinical assessment of the situation from the point of view of a man of Leverhulme's background. He condemned crofting as outdated. The crofting community were not so sure, however. Their experience led them to doubt Leverhulme's assessment. They were sceptical. They were realists in their own field, just as sure as Leverhulme was in his own field. The crofter fishermen knew from long practical experience that one or other of the two industries, fishing and crofting, invariably failed, and at such times the crofters relied on the remaining industry as an insurance against poverty. They felt they needed the two strings to their bow. Leverhulme's utopia that relied on one industry, the fishing. The success of the industry was dependent on the consistent availability of fish and on the marketplace. And neither Leverhulme nor anyone else could control either of these forces. The crofter community were fully supportive of the Leverhulme development schemes. They needed the money and were happy to do it. They were not, however, prepared to sacrifice their tried and tested way of life and their attachment to the land on which their way of life was based. Leverhulme could not understand, or did not understand, or did not want to understand. We will never know which. One thing we do know, and that is that the humble crofter's view proved to be the correct one. Leverhulme admitted in a speech before he left Louise that although his canning factory was ready, it was not an economic proposition to open it in the prevailing economic conditions of the 1920s. Alas, it never did open, although it was ready. The First World War destroyed the traditional markets for herring, and that industry never recovered. Lord Leverhulme misjudged the situation. Meantime, the landless families of Louise were not prepared to continue living in barns on other people's land. Their mood and their sentiments were expressed by one of their number and back, and I quote, "We fought for this land in France, and if necessary, we shall fight for it in Louise as well." We now come to the land raiding. Land raiding broke out all over Louis. And this, we're talking about the 1920s. The first families moved into Oranje in 1920. Then Steam River was land raided and Glen Graver. The raiders staked out crofts for themselves and prepared to cultivate the land and build homes for their families. People's power, as you might say. The same sort of thing went on all over the island, in every corner of the island. An interim interdict was taken out against the land raiders of Oranje, but it was not proceeded. Leverhulme eventually, after some struggle, Leverhulme prepared to leave the island. He made a magnanimous and magnificent offer to the crofters before he left, but that is another story. That was, he gave them their crofts, he offered them their crofts for nothing. While, however, he went off on holiday to the southern hemisphere, and no sooner was he back home to England than he died rather suddenly in 1925. Just to say a few words about Oranje and Steam River. The Department of Agriculture assisted 14 crop families to settle in Oranje. They were in the early 1920s. They were given a football to the main road outside Limerick, some 2 miles away. But it was not until 29 years later, after the Second World War, that they got a vehicle or road in 1949. In the meantime, two of their young men made the supreme sacrifice in the Second World War. Now, Steam River. Steam River was never recognized as a crofting settlement by the Department of Agriculture, despite the fact that it was scheduled for resettlement in 1912 after the passing of the Smallholder Scotland Act 1911. The half-dozen land-raiding families that settled in Steam River were not given any Department of Agriculture encouragement or assistance, no boundary fence, no roads, no quays, and no school facilities. They had to board their children out in Limerick, some 4 miles away, 4 or 5 miles away, Balallan, some 12 miles away, and Stornoway, some 30 miles away, at their own expense with friends. They also had to build their own homes without any official assistance. Obviously, the authorities were determined to squeeze the land raiders or Steam Railway out. Why was that now? Was that because of the opposition shown by the nearby sporting estate of Ishing, which was only 2 or 3 miles away? We believe the influence of the Ishkin estate ensured that the land raiders of Steam River were starved out. Another half dozen, as well as a half dozen that stopped there, another half dozen prospective settlers of Steam River withdraw without settling there. Some of those that did settle returned to Limerick because the pressure of overcrowding in Limerick was easing off in the 1920s, in the later 1920s. Only two of the land raiding families stayed in Steam River for about 20 years. Donald Morrison, the last person, moved out after his wife died in the middle of the Second World War in his old age, and went to live with his daughter in Chaws. And that was the end of Steam Railway. Word on Glen Graver now. Landless families from Graver squatted on the common grazing at Glen Graver from about 1920. They pleaded with the Department of Agriculture to recognize them as smallholders, but some of them were there 14 years before the department recognized them and created 15 small holdings as a resettlement scheme. By that time it was too late, and one of the land holdings, number 14, was never occupied. The men of Glen Graver were only there for 5 years after being recognized, when they were called up for service in the Second World War. Some of them did not return. Glen Graver was the last land resettlement in the Park Peninsula. In the meantime, the population of the Park Peninsula has dropped from nearly 2,000 souls to over 400 now, most of which are elderly. That is the end of my tale.